The world is reckoning with racial injustice, and those of us in public radio are not immune.
You know, we need to emphasize the public in our name and in our mission. It's not just a word that's there as a formality or for show. When you love something, you love it enough to sort of hold it accountable.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, July 9th, we'll talk public radio and how the movement for racial equity is playing out inside our own newsrooms. Also on the show today, the Supreme Court has ruled that a New York subpoena for the president's tax returns can move forward, but Congress still has to wait. Plus, we chat with Christina Constantini about her new documentary about the life of Walter Mercado, the television astrologer so many Latinos came to love.
For the Latino community in particular, we needed to hear a message of hope. He was talking to immigrants, largely in this country, who came here with very little and were working very hard.
But first, in the midst of a nationwide push for racial justice in all aspects of American life, you may have heard that public media is having a reckoning of its own. Journalists and staff are speaking out at public media stations across the country about failed promises to create diverse newsrooms and sharing stories of racism they've experienced in the workplace that goes back decades and stretches into the present day. We're seeing this at stations including KPCC in California, WAMU in Washington, D.C., and even here at WNYC, The Takeaway's home station. Public media has historically been a very white medium, serving largely white audiences, even though it prides itself on being independent, representative, and dramatically different from traditional for-profit media. Whether public media can truly live up to that mission is where we start today on The Takeaway. Joining us to talk about the challenges in public media and his own experience in the industry is Lee Hill, a Black journalist who's been working in public media for nearly 20 years. Lee was the first Black man in the newsroom at Colorado Public Radio in 2011, and today he's the executive producer of The Takeaway and the only Black executive producer at WNYC. Lee, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, good to be here, Tanzina.
I think for a lot of journalists of color, public media isn't the initial place we end up. So how did you end up coming into the space?
So I actually started in journalism when I was 15 years old, working at a local Black newspaper in Milwaukee, my hometown. And of course, that was in public media. But then when I went to college at Howard University in Washington, D.C., I met Doug Mitchell, who is a mentor to many people through a program called the Next Generation Radio Project. You know, participating in that program, which has always been an extension of NPR, that was my baptism into public media. So I started as an intern in 2003 and eventually got my foot in the door and worked my way up through a series of temp jobs until I became full-time and permanent.
Lee, you were the only and the first Black man in an all-white newsroom at Colorado Public Radio. What was that experience like for you?
That experience was really interesting and also very hard. I left NPR to go to Colorado Public Radio because I wanted more experience covering local news. And I knew that, from looking at the website, I knew that I would be the only person of color there. I did not know that I would be the first Black person, and I think person of any color, working in that newsroom. And so that was hard because, you know, while I'm proud of the work that I did and, you know, made a lot of inroads with, you know, engaging the community and bringing new voices into the reporting there, but I carried the burden of being the first. And the burden is a blessing, but it's also a burden because there's no precedent. You know, I remember a colleague telling me they wanted to, you know, take me out for a beer to try and understand what it's like to be Black in America, as if that conversation could be summed up, you know, by having a beer.
It could be handled over a beer, of course.
Right. And so I going into Black and brown communities while at Colorado Public Radio, you know, no one else sort of had that assignment. You know, I remember going to a Juneteenth celebration in the city of Denver to try and sort of get new sources. And I invited everyone from the newsroom at the time to come and to come and, you know, sort of join me at this event, and just so that the station could have a presence, and no one wanted to come. Our news director came at the time for a little bit, but after a while, she left. And so it was just me. And so I think that people relegated, you know, any sort of diversity work to the only Black guy.
Journalists of color, Black journalists, Latino journalists, and others are often expected to cover people of color, right? Communities of color, Black and brown people. But I think the experience of being the one, the only, or even if you're a handful of, you know, onlys, if you will, it can be distracting in some ways because you're constantly, you know, in this state of understanding your otherness or feeling othered. Did you find that it was distracting to have to constantly deal with that, as you described it, that burden as you were trying to just do your journalism?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, I actually fell into a deep depression during my time there. I mean, I felt incredibly lonely. I felt like I had the support of the audience and journalists at other institutions, but I felt like me being sort of the only Black person, just I didn't really have support. That was really lonely and that was really hard. I would call people back in DC at NPR, actually. Michelle Martin was always a great ear, and kind of vent to her about how lonely it was. And she would just tell me, you know, just keep going. But yeah, it was hard. And I did feel otherwise.
One of the things that public radio in particular is criticized for is its history of discriminating against certain kinds of on-air voices. And I think this sort of gets into who sounds, quote unquote, white and who doesn't. And if you don't sound the way that public radio hosts have traditionally sounded or public radio reporters have traditionally sounded, you can have a face a tough time. I mean, was that something that you experienced, Lee?
It was not at NPR. So I was on the air every week at NPR for about 3 years, doing a weekly segment on the show Tell Me More. And that was fine. I got a lot of support internally, and you know, it was a popular segment with the audience called Back Talk. But when I went to Colorado, it was interesting because I felt scrutinized like I had never been on the air before. The amount of scrutiny of being told that I sounded weird. I remember one host there, when I would track with this person, they would say, "Take that again, you sound weird there." Or, you know, and I've never felt so torn apart, really, in my delivery and in my performance. I did experience that. And, you know, I mean, eventually, I mean, I'm in an executive role now, and I love this job, and, you know, leading you all and leading this team. But I have to say that it was one of my motivations for getting off the air. I felt really damaged by that experience.
Wow. Stories like what you're describing are really becoming, I mean, journalists are usually not the story, right? We are not supposed to be the story. And yet, the past couple of weeks have been really intense for so many Black journalists and journalists of color who are sharing their stories, both in public radio, in public media, but even beyond. We're hearing stories about what it's like to work at the New York Times. I have my own experiences there as, you know, as a Latina, as the one of the few people who was a business reporter of color, right? And we're starting to hear more and more about just how difficult this is. Are we risking a lot, Lee, by telling our stories? Are we risking too much?
I think that the arc is finally bending toward justice, right? I think that what we're seeing in the world with, you know, the protests around the killing of George Floyd and demands actually for racial equity and racial justice and to be treated fairly are making their way into the workplace, and now making their way into newsrooms, and now making their way into public media newsrooms. And so I think that there is a risk. You know, listen, there are fine people at Colorado Public Radio who are, many of them are lovely. There are wonderful people at New York Public Radio and at WNYC. And I think that, you know, in this moment, we are having to say to many of those wonderful people, hey, this actually needs to be better and we can do better. And listen, the reason why I've been in public media for almost 20 years because I love it. When you love something, you love it enough to sort of hold it accountable. And I love what I do. I love being in an industry that is sort of supposed to be rooted in higher ideals and welcoming the voices of all people into our editorial processes and sort of going beneath the headlines and not telling people what to think, but telling people what to think about. I love that. And so because I love that, you can always count on me to push us toward our potential. That is why I'm here. And, you know, this is a conversation I have with my bosses who I really believe mean well. And, you know, this is the conversation that we'll continue to have as people of color. And I think the good news is, I think that because of some of these headlines, I think that people are starting to get it. I'm excited about what getting it looks like. I hope that it gets better.
At WNYC, you are the one Black executive producer we have. And there is, in our own home, there is a reckoning happening at WNYC and at New York Public Radio, where more than 150 employees signed a letter asking for management to be accountable to the vision that it has stated of diversity and of diverse leadership. You're sort of at the crossroads there because you're both the highest ranking or one of the highest ranking Black editors at the company. And yet, you know, how do you navigate that space of leadership in a time when there are so even fewer people up there and there's this reckoning happening behind you?
It's very hard, Tenzina. It's very hard. Actually, last night I had a moment where I just sat and, you know, it's really hard. I'm glad to have a seat at the table and I'm glad that I have access to our CEO and I'm glad that I have access to our chief content officer and I have their ear and I have no issue registering with them. And they're kind to always listen. You're right. I'm the only Black executive producer here. So one of the things that I've had to do recently is, you know, sort of lean into building a network. You know, I'm very good friends with Kenya Johnson Young, who's the first ever Black woman to be the executive producer of Morning Edition at NPR. And I'm actually working to build a network of other Black executive producers in the business, Black executive producers and Black editors in chief. So, you know, I'm very close with Matt Thompson, who's editor in chief at Reveal. You know, there are a couple other people like Kiana Burns, who's executive broadcast producer of Good Morning America. And so there's some of us who were starting to come together and sharing stories and laughter and, you know, just getting out of our own heads because it is lonely. It is lonely. And I mean, and also just, you know, self-care and making sure that, you know, I keep a therapist employed.
I think many of us do these days.
That's really important. So, yeah, it is hard. You know, we also have at WNYC, we have a great head of diversity, Brenda Williams, who's, you know, really working hard with me and with others to move the needle and push us to the best version of ourselves as an organization.
We are often expected to sort of represent and speak for entire communities, whether it's explicit or not. Expanding that diversity would almost take that burden off of us, I think, and allow more of a representative representation, if you will, of who people of color really are. The more people you have, the more diverse views you have. Lee, do you have a message for the largely still white leadership in public media today, given your 20 years of experience, given the different roles that you've had, and given the mission of public media, which is meant to, at least in theory, hold itself to a higher standard for fairness, for inclusion, than for for-profit media?
This world is a beautiful sort of mosaic of different experiences and ethnicities and cultures and struggles and pain. We do better to our audience by making sure that the people who we employ to tell those stories reflect the country that we report on and the world that we report on. Michelle Norris, the former host of All Things Considered at NPR, another friend of mine, used to put it this way. She used to always emphasize the public in public radio, like this is national public radio. And I think that, you know, we need to emphasize the public, you know, in our name and in our mission. It's not just a word that's there as a formality or for show. We really do feel like we have a mission to serve all people. And I think in order to do that well, we need to reflect that. And we need to reflect the country in the people we hire and the people who are making decisions. It's just good business. It's just good business. And it's also, I think that we're made better when we're working alongside people who don't always look like us or who have different life experiences. I know that I've been better, you know, for that in many situations. And I think that, yeah, I think that we just got to do better. Now's the time. We got to do better.
Well, I can tell you that I am deeply grateful for your leadership, Lee. And you've been a wonderful light for us here at The Takeaway. Lee Hill is the executive producer of The Takeaway. Lee, thanks so much.
Good to be here with you, Jenzina.
And we should note that in an email to staff, New York Public Radio CEO Goli Shekoslami said, quote, "Put bluntly, New York Public Radio in its entire history has yet to meet its aspiration and obligation to reflect the full diversity of our city and listeners we serve. We have failed to recruit, mentor, promote, and retain diverse talent, especially our Black reporters and editors." Goli goes on to announce several steps the organization is taking, including plans to swiftly hire two Black editors and create an internal council on racial equity. Public radio has a history of being predominantly white, making it difficult for people of color to have any significant representation. And that's both in newsrooms and in the actual storytelling. But for the past 20 years, one behind-the-scenes program has been working to change the public radio landscape. Doug Mitchell is the founder and director of NPR's Next Generation Radio and has been mentoring journalists for years. And we just heard from our executive producer, Lee Hill, talk about Doug's influence on his career, and countless others in public radio have gone through the program as well. Doug, hey, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Briefly, can you tell us how you got into public radio? And when did you realize there was a problem with representation? Was it early on?
Well, I'm originally from Oklahoma. I graduated from Oklahoma State University, and I started out at station KOSU. And I probably noticed before that, because I was the editor of my high school newspaper, and I was the only one. And growing up there, I was often the only one in a lot of places. And, you know, you get a little used to it. I had aspirations during my time at KOSU. I would listen to Morning Edition, and I'd hear Bob Edwards, and I'd say, I want to do that. Didn't want to be necessarily Bob Edwards, but I wanted to work for NPR. So I ended up leaving Oklahoma, coming to D.C., sort of a Grapes of Wrath, becoming East. Worked at a record store, nagged NPR, and finally got hired. And my aspiration was to sit at the table where they made decisions. And then after I got to the table, I was kind of like, wow, this isn't really what I thought it was. I'm shortening a lot of it, but it's like, there's something I should do, and I probably should just go ahead. So I joined the National Association of Black Journalists in the early 90s. Noticed they had print, noticed they had TV, but there was no radio. And so I went a couple of times to a couple of conferences, and then went to the Unity Journalist 94 Project conference, and then did a radio project there. And I got so inspired by it, I started up the NABJ Radio Project in 1995 and just sort of went from there.
So, Doug, we're talking a lot about racial diversity in public radio, but there are other types of diversity that public radio also struggles with, and that's class and also geographic diversity. Can you tell us a little bit about why that's so important?
Well, as I've mentioned, I'm originally from Oklahoma, and, you know, we started out doing our projects on the coasts, which enabled us to kind of get a runway. But being from the middle part of America, it's you know, we've started making inroads there. So, for example, we go to University of Nevada, Reno. We're going to go to Colorado. Let me try that again.
Sure.
It's pandemic time, so I have to remember.
Okay.
So being from Middle America, it's important for us to be there as well. I have goals of doing a project with tribes in Indian country. We're going to do a project with Colorado this year. And there are other places I would like to go over in parts of the country which are fairly untapped, because I think there's talent everywhere. There is. And it's important for us to, in the day that we can show up physically and be there, we should do that.
Doug, you've been organizing this NPR Next Generation Radio program for so long. Lee and other staff members on The Takeaway have been a part of it. You've been a mentor to me, but you've also been a mentor to so many journalists of color in this industry. Without revealing individual stories, I'm wondering, what are the big themes that you hear from the journalists of color that you mentor as far as some of the struggles that they face in the industry?
Yeah, so when I started up these projects, the idea was to provide a runway. How do we get people in? I mean, I just showed up, and that was pre-9/11, so I was able to just kind of walk in the building, pretend I knew what I was doing, and I could get in. It's not like that anymore. There are literal walls preventing people from getting in. So there needed to be a way. So I decided, let's focus on younger people, younger than me anyway, and provide some sort of way in which they get in. So let's have them audition in front of us. So let me create a training project. They'll do some traditional reporting. They'll do some writing. I'll find people in our system who are interested in also mentoring. And we'll just be relentless. We'll just do it time after time after time. And so after NABJ, I joined AAJA. I joined NAJA, Native American Journalists Association. I joined the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and then Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association because, as Lee said and Michelle Martin says, public is public. Public means everybody. So I joined all those organizations, started up radio training, and then in 2000, that's when I decided to name it Next Generation Radio. Because we were doing so many, the journalism conferences, in addition to three NPR stations where we would travel to do projects. So the themes that I'm actually hearing now after doing all this work, once you get in, it becomes harder. And I think that is probably the biggest roadblock to diversifying our industry, is that it's the retention issue. It's like once you get in, you sit at that table, like myself back when I was when I got started, you got to the table and you realized you may have been one of a few, but you sit at that table where you realize you're either going to be microaggressively reduced or you're going to be waved off. And if you, like, I'm very stubborn and I refuse to accept that, and which is why I'm still here. But if you're not like that, you're going to leave. And so my role, when you talk about mentorship, is my role is to make sure that those who come through our program don't leave, don't. And so that's why I do all the mentoring. That's why I do all the conversations. I do all the coaching.
And you do more than mentoring, Doug. I mean, you do a lot of, as one of the few Black journalists in public radio who's been doing this work for as long as you have, you're really creating a support network for people and connecting
exactly.
Other journalists of color. How do we, Doug, how do we get, not just in terms of retention, because I know that's a big problem, but how do we even get people to the levels that Lee, for example, is at, that I'm at? Like, how do we diversify all the way up the spectrum and not just in the internships or the low-level producer roles, which are critical, but really we want to have conversations. I think this reckoning is really about power.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And so one of the things we've done, thankful to technology, is that with Next Gen Radio, we have now 430-plus people in our Slack community. And this, my being at home the last 3.5 months has really given me an opportunity to really think about our work going forward. And so now we have a little bit of a small town. And so it's not just about the project and the auditioning anymore. It is, we are a community that does projects. We're not projects that result in community. And so as the founder, director, I call myself the work dad, it is my responsibility, I think, and our responsibility as those who are mentors with our program to ensure that those we're bringing into our community have someone to talk to. If they have a question, even the smallest question, that they feel comfortable asking it. If they're sitting in that meeting and somebody says something and they think it's a little weird, you can send me a private Slack message or an email and ask me about that.
You all heard that, everybody. You're going to get a lot of slacks, Doug. Doug Mitchell is the founder and director of NPR's Next Generation Radio, whose Slack channel will probably explode. Doug, great to talk to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And we know public media fans may have thoughts on this, so call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Supreme Court ruled on two cases involving the president's long-sought-after financial records. The first was a 7-2 ruling against the Trump administration, which said President Trump cannot shield his tax returns and financial documents from a grand jury in New York. And the second case dealt with congressional subpoenas of the president's financial records, which the court kicked back to lower courts to decide. Zoe Tillman is a legal reporter with BuzzFeed News, and she joins us now. Zoe, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Chief Justice John Roberts in the first court case wrote, quote, since the beginning of the Republic, quote, every man has included the president of the United States. Tell us in the context of this first ruling, Zoe, what does that mean?
The big takeaway is that state prosecutors in New York will get what Trump has long refused to give up voluntarily, which is years and years of his tax returns. The court rejected Trump's argument that as a sitting president, he should be absolutely immune from facing a grand jury subpoena. And the court also rejected an argument from the Justice Department that prosecutors should at least have to meet some kind of heightened standard before they can issue this kind of subpoena.
Now, it's interesting because The Atlantic's Adam Serwer, his initial response to this was that he tweeted, Trump is not king. Without using those exact words, that feels like what the Supreme Court is the message that we're getting from this ruling.
Right. What the court said is that Trump still had options to challenge a grand jury subpoena. He could raise the same types of legal challenges that any other person could make when facing a subpoena for documents in a criminal investigation. And he could even raise arguments that are specific to his position as president. But the gist was that he doesn't get special treatment in terms of process when state prosecutors are trying to get information as part of a state criminal investigation.
What happens now after this ruling comes out today? What are the next steps, as far as New York is concerned and accessing the president's financial records?
Trump could now try to go back to court and get the subpoena tossed out on other grounds. He could argue it's unlawful. He could raise, you know, constitutional concerns about the legality of a subpoena for his records, given his position as president. But it's not that he gets any kind of special end run around the subpoena. He still has to go through the same process as everyone else does. And if he doesn't, it means that these financial institutions will have to turn over his tax returns to the grand jury in New York.
Cannot imagine that the president is happy about this. We've seen the response statement from Manhattan DA Cy Vance on this, saying that they, quote, were guided, as always, by the grand jury's solemn obligation to follow the law and the facts wherever they may lead. The president has been tweeting about this today. What's the gist of what he has to say, Zoe?
He is very unhappy. He sees this as part of the broader quote unquote witch hunt against him. He's, you know, referenced the Mueller investigation again. He sees this all as what he said is a political prosecution. And he specifically said that it was not fair, quote, that he had to keep fighting in a politically corrupt New York.
Is there anything that we're going to be looking for if and when these documents, the New York is able to get the documents, and maybe at some point they'll be available even for public consumption? I mean, what other than the fact that all presidential candidates so far give these documents up as part of their candidacy and we haven't seen them, is there something specific there's also we're looking for here in terms of criminality?
I mean, the investigation that the New York District Attorney's Office is undertaking has to do, at least in part, with the hush money payments that President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, had orchestrated for two women who had claimed to have affairs with the president. So the first question would be, do the tax returns offer any insight into that scandal? And then separately, you know, there have always been questions about his business dealings overseas, whether he did business with foreign governments prior to taking office, whether he had business interests that may have continued after becoming president, or at least for the Trump Organization, of which he still has financial interests, even as he's given over day-to-day control to his family. So there's a lot of information that we could get from these tax returns. It's just not clear. We don't know what's in them until we see them.
How did the Supreme Court rule there? They kicked this back to a lower court, right?
Right. This was not a, you know, complete win for the president. The court said that there may be situations where Congress could subpoena personal financial records that belong to a sitting president. But what they did was delay this fight to the point that it's very unlikely the public or members of Congress, for that matter, would see any of these documents before the election. What the court did was say the lower courts that had ruled that Trump's financial institutions, his accounting firm, his banks, the lower courts had said they did have to turn over documents to these committees. The Supreme Court said these courts failed to grapple with the serious separation of powers issues that were implicated when a congressional committee issued a subpoena related to a sitting president, even if it had to do with his personal records and not his official duties. So the court laid out a new four-part standard the lower courts now had to take into account in reconsidering these cases. So we've seen statements from House Democrats saying they absolutely plan to continue to fight this, but it kicks this down the road, and it could be months or beyond that if this goes back up to the Supreme Court at some later time.
Zoe, we've been following a lot of the Supreme Court decisions that have come out in recent weeks, and many of these decisions feel like they've gone against the overall stated goals of the Trump administration. How do you interpret that? I mean, is the fact here that conservative judges are more willing to side with more liberal judges in some of these cases the big takeaway?
I think the takeaway is Trump is learning a lesson that some of his predecessors have learned before, which is once you put a judge or justice on the bench and give them lifetime tenure, they are not someone that you control. And we've seen, you know, time and again, justices appointed by a president of a particular party end up making decisions that upset that particular president. And Trump has been no different. You know, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh today agreed with the Chief Justice that, for instance, the president is not protected by absolute immunity from congressional subpoenas. It's a decision that the president is very unhappy with. We've seen Justice Gorsuch write decisions as well that went against the Trump administration. And, you know, it will be interesting to see how that informs the president's upcoming updated Supreme Court nominee shortlist and whether he feels there's anything more they can do to try and pick folks if there is a vacancy that would give him more assured victories. But it's just hard to know what they're going to do once they're on the bench.
And pivoting back to the New York DA decision here, the Trump administration has had a contentious relationship with New York prosecutors, most recently with the SDNY. I'm wondering, is this latest decision just going to strain that relationship even more, given what we know today?
I think it was already pretty bad relationship. I don't know how much more tense it could get when you have a state prosecutor investigating in a criminal context a sitting president. So I think they both dug in quite a while ago in terms of expressing publicly their dislike and a lack of respect for one another. And I imagine that will continue going forward.
There we go. Zoe Tillman is a legal reporter with BuzzFeed News. Zoe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we're about 5 months into the coronavirus pandemic here in the United States, and cases are on the rise in many states. In the meantime, the race for a vaccine continues. In May, the Trump administration launched Operation Warp Speed, a partnership between government agencies and drug companies that are trying to develop a vaccine by early 2021. And the government is spending billions of dollars trying to make that happen. Katie Thomas covers the business of healthcare for the New York Times, and she joins us now. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how many companies are trying to create a vaccine right now? What is Operation Warp Speed?
Well, around the world, researchers are developing more than 145 different vaccines against the coronavirus. And Operation Warp Speed is the Trump administration's effort to try and bring a vaccine to the public as quickly as possible, perhaps before the end of the year.
We said that they're spending billions of dollars, and that's billions with the B. Is that scale comparable with past vaccine efforts? I mean, have we ever seen that much investment in something like this before?
No, this is really unlike anything in recent memory. You know, what normally happens is vaccines can take, they usually take years to develop. And one of the things that Operation Warp Speed and others are doing to try and speed this along is that as the clinical trials are going through, at the same time that these vaccines are entering the late stage clinical trials, the companies are getting paid by the federal government and others to actually ramp up their manufacturing and start making these vaccines before they even know if it works.
You said there were about 145 different vaccines in the making right now. Where does the U.S. stand compared to where the rest of the world stands in terms of trying to develop a vaccine right now?
Well, I mean, it really is a global effort because obviously, any vaccine that succeeds, you know, in one country could potentially, if everyone works together, you know, vaccinate and everyone. China is probably slightly ahead in the sense that they have a couple of vaccines that are in late stage trials. They actually have one that they have approved for the use by the military. Now, of course, in other countries compared to the U.S., they have different rules and different standards for what they deem as a safe and effective vaccine, and the U.S. will have to evaluate that on its own. The U.S. is giving probably the most money by far of any other country or entity, you know, in the world to try and make these vaccines become a reality.
There are two companies here, Moderna and Novavax, that the federal government has been giving money to. Those two companies have never brought a product to market. Katie, why is the government assuming that this time it'll be different for these two companies?
Yeah, I mean, it just highlights how this whole thing is really a huge gamble. And I think the thinking of the federal government is that they want to bet on multiple horses at the same time. They know how unpredictable vaccines are, the development of vaccines are. We never know if something's going to work until it actually goes through clinical trials. And so what they're doing is they're giving money to an array of different vaccines that are made by different companies and that have different technologies. Moderna makes this vaccine that is based on a genetic technology, and it's been doing it with the NIH. And even though they've never brought a vaccine to trial, they have kind of a newer technology that in theory can kind of be put together more quickly and developed more quickly than more traditional vaccines. And Novavax, I mean, it is a good question. They've never brought a vaccine to market. They're working on a technology that's a little bit more established and is one that kind of wasn't really in the U.S. government's portfolio before. So again, just in if you're thinking about trying to kind of place multiple bets, you want to give money to different companies that are trying different things.
Katie, I'm sure you're following that there are starting to be folks who are dealing with the long-term effects of coronavirus and COVID-19 who are struggling to pay for their treatment across the country. Insurance bills are starting to come in. For Americans who are anticipating, and I'm sure everyone around the world is really anticipating a vaccine, do we have any sense of whether insurances will be expected to cover these vaccines, how much the vaccines will end up costing? Americans right now are, you know, their faith in the drug industry is shaky given how much drug prices have skyrocketed. So what are we expecting in terms of cost?
Yes, and it's very much not sort of, I will say, we don't know yet. One thing, though, is that the Affordable Care Act did require that, you know, certain types of preventative care are covered with no out-of-pocket costs. So presumably, if there is a vaccine that works and is safe and effective, and if you have any kind of health insurance, you won't pay any out-of-pocket for your vaccine. But I think it's really an open question about if you don't have insurance, you know, who will pay for it, how much will it cost? And also broader questions about just cost to the system. How much will these companies charge the insurers for the vaccines? Because someone is paying for it.
We've got about a minute left in the segment. I'm wondering, where do clinical trials stand right now?
So we have several trials that are underway. There, according to our New York Times vaccine tracker, we've got 15. Vaccines that are in what's called phase one, which is a safety trial. And then we have 14 that are in either in phase two or phase three, which are the much broader so-called efficacy trials that test the vaccine in a broad population to understand whether it works and also what the side effects could be.
We know a lot of people here and around the world are waiting for this vaccine. Katie Thomas covers the business of healthcare for the New York Times. Katie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Que Dios los bendiga a todos, hoy, mañana y siempre. Y que reciban de mí siempre paz, mucha paz, pero sobre todo mucho, 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 mucho amor.
That was legendary astrologer Walter Mercado delivering his trademark television sign-off to viewers. And when Walter died last year, it marked a loss for millions who counted on him to deliver the hope-filled horoscopes he usually did in his extravagant style. He was Puerto Rican, and many Latinos grew up with him on their television screens.
I don't remember a time when Walter didn't exist. Whenever my grandmother would babysit me, I would watch him. And I think for me and for many Latinos around the country and around the world, he is kind of synonymous with those moments that we spent with our grandmothers, you know, laying on their laps and sitting on their linoleum floor. And for us and for me, when I look at him, I get these warm, fuzzy feelings, these feelings of nostalgia that I think a lot of Americans get for a Mr. Rogers or maybe even Big Bird. But for me, it's Walter.
That's filmmaker Christina Constantini. And in the 2 years before Walter Mercado's death, Christina, her co-director Karim Tapsch, and producer Alex Fumero spent thousands of hours interviewing the astrologer about his life and legacy. And this week, Mucho, Mucho Amor, their documentary about Walter, premiered on Netflix. Christina says that by spending so much time with him, she got to learn more about the very deliberate strategy behind his wonderfully flashy style.
What we all remember him for was mostly maybe his hair, his jewelry, and of course his capes. And so he every day would show up in a different fabulous cape, sequins, feathers, rhinestones, and deliver these horoscopes. And, you know, he said to us that he thought they were estupideces, they were stupid things that he had to do in order to get people to pay attention and to listen to his message of love and peace, which he thought was much more important. So what I didn't realize is this was all a very calculated kind of production, and he was so aware of his visual medium that he knew he had to make us stop and pay attention, and it worked. I mean, here we are talking about him. We remember him so well because of those capes and that hair and that jewelry.
Speaking of the capes and the hair and the jewelry, I mean, some people would call that gender nonconforming. But was Walter willing to discuss sexuality and gender, his own, with you?
Well, you know, there was never a question that Walter wouldn't answer. There were certain things he didn't like talking about, but he loved talking about being genderqueer or gender nonconforming, and he very much considered himself, you know, somewhere between the genders. He was incredibly ahead of his time when it came to that. Although he doesn't use the he uses the pronoun he because, you know, he was 88 years old when he passed away a few months ago. But he would say, we found a lot of old tape where he said stuff like, I think the future has no gender. The future, it will be both male and female, and we won't categorize ourselves in such a rigid way like we categorize ourselves now. And so he very much saw himself as a blending of the genders. And, you know, that's how his appearance certainly reflected that.
And you mentioned Walter was 88 when he passed away, and not only had he lived in times that may not have been as welcoming or weren't as welcoming to the LGBTQ community as they are today, as we're sort of opening up that conversation, and things were much more misogynistic and homophobic. Was that something that he experienced in his life?
I mean, absolutely. I think he never liked to focus on the bad times. So getting him to talk about anything that was difficult that he went through, he didn't like doing. He didn't like dwelling on things. But absolutely, Walter was made fun of. You know, people always did the Walter character, and not in, you know, a fun way, in a mean way. People would make fun of him for being different. But he understood that. He didn't like it. But he, you know, came up during a time when you didn't talk about your sexuality. Being gay certainly held an immense stigma. And so from a very young age, he said to his mother, you know, I feel very different inside. And she said, you should be different. And so he said that he had to create, he knew as a young boy, he had to create a famous person inside of himself in order to be able to be who he was. And so I think the Walter that we saw on television was in many ways a very elaborate, very fabulous coping mechanism to the times that he grew up in. And it was really remarkable. There was no one else that looked like Walter on television. There's very few people in the Latino community. There's Juan Gabriel, but very few people who were as bold as Walter was. And as my co-director, who's gay, would say, is he came on television every day, and although he didn't say he was gay, he showed us who he was.
When I think about Walter, I think about listening to his horoscopes and hearing him say Cancer, Libra, Leo, you know, and just kind of reading out these very dramatic horoscopes for people. But his work was rooted in different approaches to faith and spirituality. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, one of Walter's missions in life was to bring a lot of knowledge about different cultures and different religions to the Latino community. And so he spent many years of his life studying and learning, and he was always learning something new about a different religion, and he would try to integrate them into his astrology readings. So he believed in some form of interfaith religion that drew on Christianity, but also drew on, you know, astrology, which is, of course, from the ancient Greeks, and also Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam. And he was always trying to teach and meld these religions and mix them together. What he was doing was truly wild. I mean, truly ahead of his time, and didn't really happen in any other place in our community or our television, which was so dominated by, you know, guys chasing girls in bikinis or, you know, soccer. There was never, you know, Walter invented a totally new and unprecedented form of television for the Latino community.
So is that part of the reason why he is so revered as a cultural figure for so many people, Latinos, Puerto Ricans, you know, Mexicans across the board? I mean, just people who, old, young and old in many ways, grew up watching him. Is that part of the reason why he's so revered? Why does he resonate so much? Because really, I mean, he could have been considered, and maybe to a certain extent is, just, you know, somewhat campy, and that's it, right? But it feels much more weighty when we talk about the role Walter played in our community.
Absolutely. I think I actually underestimated Walter before I knew him and before I got to meet him. I thought, you know, wow, what a fun character, but I wonder, you know, what's behind that? And it's actually a very brilliant man who's very considered and deliberate. And then, of course, the costumes got us to pay attention and to keep watching. But I think for the Latino community in particular, we needed to hear a message of hope. He was talking to immigrants largely in this country who came here with very little and were working very hard. And I think he came on television every day and said, basically, if you listen pretty carefully to the horoscopes, they're pretty similar. They are, you know, Libra today. Maybe yesterday was hard, but tomorrow is going to be a better day. And I think we all need to hear that message, that tomorrow is going to be a better day. And he gave us hope, and he gave us love, which was the tenet that he lived his life by. And I think for our community, we really needed that at that time, and we still do. And I think it's such an honor to be able to release this film now, because I think the Latino community could use some of his good vibes, if you will, now more than ever.
Cristina Constantini is the co-director of Mucho, Mucho Amor. Thank you, Cristina.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, everyone, that's our show for today. But I have to give a huge thank you to the people who make this show every week. Our board operators, Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry, were in the studio at WNYC alongside director Vince Fairchild, with remote assistance from editor Jay Cowett and line producer Jackie Martin. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Polly Irungu and Dina Sayad Ahmed are our digital editors. Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our administrative assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. And if you want to get in touch with me, just hit me up on Twitter at Tanzina Vega. Amy will be in the chair tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday. Stay safe. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.